A new study shows the full range of the opioid epidemic here in Florida. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And just ahead, new data out from Florida Blue this week, looking at the true human toll of the opiate crisis in Florida. Also, what's being done to treat those who are suffering? What are your questions? You can get on the line now, 549-2937. Then later, October is National Cybersecurity Month, what you need to know to keep yourself safe online. Plus, Generation Wow, their big event for girls in Jacksonville coming up this fall, how you can get your daughter involved. All of that ahead this morning. But first, this hour, it's a new and statewide look at the impact, the true impact the opiate epidemic is having in each region of Florida. These numbers are out from Florida Blue. At the same time, the Florida Blue Foundation is awarding a grant so that local caregivers here in North Florida can refer and treat people at risk for overdose from opioids. Lots of new information as we welcome Pat Garrity, CEO of Florida Blue and Guidewell. Always good to see you. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Happy to be here.
And also with us in studio, Dr. Christine Caulfield, Executive Director of LSF Health Systems, a leading care provider in this space here in Jacksonville. Doctor, good to see you as well.
Great to see you, Melissa. Thank you.
And here's our question to callers. As we look at the true cost of the opiate epidemic around Florida, what are your questions, comments? What are your personal stories? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. We're already getting your comments on our Facebook page as well. So, Pat Garrity, let's begin with you. Florida Blue hosted a big forum about this in Central Florida this week, and then you revealed some new statistics showing the impact of the crisis. What do the numbers show?
Well, yes, Melissa. We had this forum at our Innovation Center, and we commissioned an organization called Westat to look at the data from across the country. The latest data are from 2010 through 2016, but we're looking at 42,000 deaths a year from opioids.
In Florida?
Across the country.
Across the country.
In Florida, it was about 3,000 in 2016 alone. And so what we're seeing is through that period of time, prescription opioids was actually rising as an issue. In the last year and a half, we're seeing a little bit of the prescription opioids on decline, but we're seeing much more of the fentanyl and some of the illicit opioids that are causing greater problems in the community.
How were you able to track this information and gather this data together?
We got it from a number of different sources, publicly reported information. It can now be accessed on our Guidewell Innovations website. You can go there and look at this data. But we used a lot of publicly available sources from various states across the nation because we wanted to compare Florida to other states so we understood on a relative basis how we were doing and also where to go for good examples of who's getting ahead of this issue.
And are we more impacted than surrounding states? I would think we might be.
Yeah, we're significantly impacted. We're about 18th in the country, so not necessarily at our relative size. But what we saw were really good examples from Connecticut, from Vermont, and from Ohio. And we invited all three of those states to be represented at our forum to tell us what they're doing and what they're learning so we could learn from them.
We'll go to your calls in a moment for Florida Blue and LSF Health Systems about the opiate crisis. It's 549-2937. Dr. Christine Caulfield, fortuitous you're here today to talk about this because the Florida Blue Foundation has actually awarded your organization, LSF Health Systems, a $2 million grant so that your model of care, which is so outstanding, can better help people, better address this. Tell us about what you're doing and how this money will help your efforts.
Absolutely. And we can't be more grateful to Florida Blue, who frankly is the leader in our state in fighting this epidemic. We are very fortunate to partner with Florida Blue and two of our providers, LifeStream and Meridian Behavioral Healthcare, located in both Gainesville and Leesburg. And the model that we've adopted in working with Florida Blue is really, let's look at getting in at an earlier stage. Let's look at training healthcare professionals, particularly in emergency departments and our primary care physicians, to detect on an early level who might be coming in with an undiagnosed substance abuse disorder. So we are rolling out training for the ESPRT, which stands for Screening, Brief Intervention, Referral, and Treatment. It's a brief screening that when the physicians offer it, they are able to get a quick score and detect whether an individual might be struggling with a substance abuse disorder. We're going to place peer specialists as well as clinicians in the primary care facilities as well as our emergency departments in these areas to then help that individual, motivate them to consider treatment so that we can really move them along into recovery.
That's the goal. Recovery is possible.
Absolutely. I don't want anyone to think that there is not hope. Recovery is possible, and we just need to get folks the help that they need.
Now, Pat Garrity, let me ask you as well, how does this public health emergency impact your business? How does this affect a major insurer?
Well, it affects us in a lot of ways. When we lay out our mission as a company, our mission is to help people and communities achieve better health. So this is something that is impacting the health of individuals and our communities. One of the things we did first was to look at the prescription and the length of the prescription that was being given in the community as a standard. I can speak to last year I had knee surgery. I was given a 30-day supply of opioids. I needed one day. So now I have 29 days of opioids sitting in my home. That's where this crisis develops. Some people take it for too long. Some people keep it around in their home, and now it's available to their children. And so it's getting ahead of that. So we worked with the Florida legislature to limit the length of the prescriptions. We're also doing a lot around education, because there are many over-the-counter drugs that could take the place of opioids for a wide variety of pain situations.
Like what? What would be a good substitute?
It could be Tylenol. It could be Motrin. It could be a number of
just
different products that people are aware of.
Relievers, yeah.
That do just as good a job.
And Dr. Caulfield, do you feel that doctors have gotten the memo on tightening up how freely they used to prescribe opioids?
Yes, I do. And we really want to applaud the Florida legislature for moving that important piece of legislation forward, because now in Florida, doctors are allowed to just prescribe 3 opioid pills. And, you know, one thing that we need to really recognize is that opioids are utilized for acute pain, not chronic pain. So they never should have been prescribed on a long-term basis.
But sadly they were, and that's how so many people went from pain relief to seeking out street fentanyl.
That is
and
correct.
And overdosing.
Indeed.
And the brain chemistry of people factors in as well. Not everyone is going to, as Pat said, get a prescription, take a few pills, and get addicted. Some people are more at risk than others. But we still don't know a lot about that aspect of this public health crisis, do we? It's not easy to predict who might be more susceptible to becoming addicted.
Right. Well, there certainly is a genetic component to addiction. And, you know, when a person does have that genetic predisposition, they are at much higher risk. Other factors play in as well. But, you know, you can really become quickly addicted to opioids, and that is the danger of this drug.
And if you're just tuning in, as we speak with Florida Blue and LSF Health Systems about the new data looking at the full scope of the opiate crisis in Florida, what are your thoughts, comments, and questions? It's 549-2937 to give us a call. John is on the line. Hi, John. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hey, I'm sorry. My wife is dealing with chronic pain and has been for years. I think everybody's on the right track as far as monitoring usage for short term, and it might be that after 7 days you call somebody back in for a reevaluation, But for people who are, I guess, functionally addicted because they have to take this medication every day of their lives, I'm concerned that we're setting up barriers. We're setting up scores that aren't personalized. We're putting doctors in a position to take this input that's generic and apply it in a specific situation, and that can be a challenge.
Pat Garrity.
Well, I think, first of all, each individual case is it's has to be judged on its own merits, and that's why you need a clinician involved in that. But you also need to make sure that we have the right pain management advice being given to that provider. Not all providers of care are as versed in pain management as others. And so that's part of having experts that are in this equation. So I understand your concern. One of the things we're very concerned about and we want to educate on is taking the stigma away from people who are in an addicted state. It really needs to be treated as a medical condition and not a condition that in an advanced state becomes something that law enforcement and courts are dealing with. And that's why at our forum, we had law enforcement and we had a judge there to talk about their perspective, because it's really important that we're looking at this holistically.
Do you feel the criminal justice system is reframing the way they look at addiction and how punitive they can be with individuals who are addicted?
I think the learning is starting to emerge. I think people are starting to move down that path. And I think it's really important that we as a society do not turf to law enforcement and courts the resolution of an issue that is medical. And so I think we have a real obligation to step up as a medical community.
Dr. Caulfield, do you agree? You're nodding your head.
Absolutely agree. And at LSF Health Systems, we're very involved in working with sheriff's departments, judges, other individuals in the Department of Corrections to really educate and raise awareness that addiction is a brain disease. It's a chronic disease, just like heart disease, diabetes, and other diseases. It should not be criminalized. And so we're offering training like mental health first aid. We're offering trainings and crisis intervention training for our law enforcement personnel to help them understand about addiction and mental illness and not criminalize this health crisis.
Septimus is on the line. Is that your name? Good morning. You're on the air. Are you with us? Hey, you're on the air. Good morning, Septimus.
Okay. Back in the early 70s, I had impacted wisdom teeth removed, and they removed the top two first and gave me a prescription for it was a combination of codeine and acetaminophen that was widely prescribed back then.
Same thing happened to me. And, yep, and I remember that. I remember those days.
About the bottom two, which are more painful, and I filled out that prescription, and they gave me a prescription for that one. And that one was so bad, I filled them, you know, used up one, and then I filled the other. And that worked fine, and I never heard of people getting addicted from that. Now, a few years ago, I had a hernia surgery, and the pain was really bad, and they gave me one of these modern opioids. And it turned out to be worthless for abdominal surgery because it causes constipation, and then the drug that you're supposed to take to relieve the constipation, there's a maximum as to how much you can take a day, and it's not enough to combat the opioid. Since the acetaminophen and codeine combination works so well, why do they come up with these more powerful things that are addictive?
That is such a great question. I'm so glad you asked that. Let's ask both of these experts. You know, his story, the exact same process happened with me when I was in college. They removed a bunch of impacted wisdom teeth. They sent me home with codeine. I think it was mixed with acetaminophen. I was high as a kite for a couple of weeks taking this stuff. It makes you feel euphoric. And then I went back to college and I never sought any more of it out again. I didn't get addicted to it. But as he pointed out, that was a different compound than what is being prescribed today. So what's the difference between them? Why don't they prescribe that anymore? And can you explain the chain of events that's led to what we're the good doctor will answer this question. Yes.
Okay. So we have to look back at history, and Purdue Pharma came up with this this drug, the oxycodone and the opioids, and basically told physicians that this was non-addictive and it was a better drug to control pain than codeine and other agents. And so our physicians certainly were looking to help their patients that were experiencing pain. They were assured that this was not going to be addictive. And then they began to prescribe. What they did not realize was that information was not accurate, that the opioid was very, very addictive. But by that time, we had millions of people, literally, that became mm-hmm. quickly addicted to the opioids.
So Purdue and the other big pharmaceutical companies are now facing a raft of lawsuits over this, including from the city of Jacksonville, because of the cost. It's the toll on municipalities. Where are you both on that?
So I actually think that the pharma industry does bear a lot of responsibility here. They did advance these drugs widely in the community. And I can tell you, I'm proud to say that Florida Blue was the first insurance company to take oxycodone off of our approved list. So it is the most addictive of the prescription opioids, and we took it out because it could be replaced by things that were less addictive. Mm-hmm. And that is really one of the critical elements here. Medication-assisted therapy is one of the main avenues that we have to fight this situation. And so we absolutely believe in moving down the trail, if you will, to lesser addictive drugs as one of the ways to do this. Again, the stigma is, gee, you're replacing a drug for a drug, and people mm-hmm. think of all kinds of negative things related to that. We really do have to take this on medically and move down that pathway. But pharma owns a lot of the responsibility here.
Do you agree?
Yes, I agree. And another thing that happened historically is that Big Pharma really pushed legislatively to have pain as the fifth HEDIS score, which means
the fifth vital sign, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And so when you are admitted to a hospital or you went into your physician's office, one of the things, the critical things that was mandated is that they ask about your pain level. And hospitals were literally penalized if they were not getting good consumer reports that their customers were happy about how they manage pain. So it really added to the crisis.
It was well intended, but like a lot of things, the road to hell is paved with, okay. Daryl in St. Augustine. Hi, Daryl. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, you're absolutely right. This is a medical condition created by the medical industry. I think that Big Pharma should be charged with murder, the CEO and the rest of them. My son has attended 4 funerals from kids he went to school with. Now, I have never attended a single funeral, and I'm 57, from anybody that I went to school with. And every one of them were from drugs, and it was pills, not heroin, pills that have killed these kids. Now, if that's not murder, I don't know what is. You knew it was addictive.
Yeah, Daryl, I completely appreciate your outrage on this. And, you know, it's not really all that different from the big lawsuits against tobacco that we saw in the 90s, tobacco being held accountable for so much death and pain.
Melissa, I absolutely empathize with the caller. I played football, basketball, baseball growing up. You twisted your ankle, you soaked it in ice, you took perhaps a Tylenol. I mean, there are lots of ways to treat those things. We got to a place where we were giving opioids to high school athletes to take care of little pains that they had from playing, and we made them addicts mm-hmm. in many cases. So a lot of people have experienced just exactly what the caller said, and there has to be accountability for that, and we've got to rein this in.
On the other hand, here's a comment on our Facebook page from Ariel. What about chronic pain patients? They're being robbed of their quality of life. As the free prescription of these meds is tightening up, for people that do have a legitimate need for these, what are their options, doctor?
You know, that's a very good point. And what we see for many folks is when they were unable to get their opioid prescriptions filled, they turn to the streets because heroin has that same type of component that gives the same effect. The problem with the heroin on the streets is it's being laced with deadly fentanyl and carfentanyl, and that is the components that are causing the opioid deaths and overdoses. But as Pat stated earlier, there are other options. If you find yourself addicted to opioids, there is medication-assisted treatment. Methadone is one agent that is being proven very effective in helping titrate off of the opioids.
Isn't there controversy around methadone too, though?
There is some controversy, particularly for those individuals that are believing that you're just replacing one drug for another. However, the best practice, the medical literature is supporting that this is a very effective means of helping people reduce that dependence on opioids, being able to now function, hold down a job, keep their children in place. You know, we've had such community consequences, one being that our child welfare system has been stretched to the limit. There has been a 30% rise in children moving into the child welfare system, foster care system, due to the deaths of their parents from these opioid overdoses. So we have to do something that reduces the craving, that ameliorates that situation so that people can keep their families intact, hold down a job, and move forward.
Let me ask you both about the racial aspect of this as well. Here is a comment on Facebook from Rhoda. There's a huge disparity in treatment for the mainly white community affected by the opioid epidemic, while the black community hooked on crack receives jail time, ruined lives, families torn apart. And that has been an observation many have made. You know, as this crisis has extended into every corner of America, affecting lower income to higher income communities, people of all races, people of color have pointed out, well, now white America cares because other white people are being affected by this. What are your thoughts about all of that? Pat?
Yeah, first of all, I think there's a fair comment that's being made here. And so we don't turn a blind eye to that issue. I think addiction, all addiction, has to come under this umbrella. Certainly, opioids got a lot of attention because of how many people died and how quickly it became a situation where people would die. Fentanyl absolutely escalated the issue. Literally, a couple of dots of fentanyl can take you out. And so that was a big issue for anybody involved and people who are accidentally exposed, including law enforcement. Therefore, it got attention. But I think the broader question being raised by this person who sent that note in is absolutely right. We must, as a society, deal with addiction across the board. And again, I would say addiction has to be treated medically. If we leave addiction to be done by law enforcement and the courts, we're doing a disservice to everyone.
Marion has been holding. Marion in Jacksonville. Hi, Marion. Good morning.
Hi, Melissa. Thank you for taking my call. A few minutes ago, Dr. Caulfield had mentioned about the treatment for pain and how people become addicted to drugs in that process. I wanted to ask Mr. Garrity, how is the insurance company dealing with coverage and benefits for pain management and using alternative treatments as opposed to drug treatments? I'm talking specifically about physical treatment like yoga, even acupuncture, and even going not so much as an alternative treatment, but, well, yes, thinking of using and covering of cannabis for medical purposes.
Okay. Thanks for that question.
Yes. So there's a lot that's happening. I started before by mentioning that we were the largest advocate for limiting the size of the prescription. That was an important first step. In addition to that first step, we've also been doing things like a grant to LSF to be looking at alternative ways of treating folks that before they're fully addicted to opioids. We also gave a grant to an organization called Yoga for Change. So we're looking for alternative sources, and we need to see evidence that it works. So,
and if you do, then maybe you'd cover those treatments more broadly.
That's right. So in any place that you look in the medical field, you need evidence. You need to try something. You need to see that it can work. That's why clinical trials happen. That's why we give grants to alternative procedures. If we get evidence that that's going to take hold and work, then we're very interested in advocating for benefit changes. Once again, those happen at a state level where you have to get it approved through the regulatory process.
Yeah, surely it's complicated, but Dr. Caulfield, what about that? Certainly a lot of patients seek out those modalities even if insurance isn't covering them, because they just find relief that way.
Absolutely. And again, a big shout out to Florida Blue for being a leader in and looking at alternative ways to manage pain. I certainly support any type of alternative method that is not going to cause harm and, in fact, improve patient's pain level. Acupuncture, as the caller mentioned, yoga, and other alternatives.
What about cannabis? I think she also mentioned cannabis.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of research going on now regarding the efficacy of cannabis oil. So I think that when the research is completed and we're finding through clinical trials that this certainly is an effective means to treat pain, I would not be surprised if that's going to be on the list for reimbursement.
Karen in Mandarin. Hey, Karen, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is, I want to know why this discussion is being had when everybody knew in the 19th century how addictive opioids were. And this big discussion about, you know, pharma's influence is just bogus. I mean, of course, it was there. But what about the doctors? They didn't know that opioids were addictive. Everybody is missing the point. And the point is that if there's money to be made, everything else is suppressed. And, you know, they act like there's somehow no fault here. And frankly, I can't believe we're talking to an insurance company, because everybody was well aware of the effects of opioids the first time I ever heard of it. And I don't have a medical degree. Oh, God, why are they doing that? That's got to be terribly addictive. I mean, I just really...
Yep, we're losing her, but we get your point, Karen. Okay, she's angry. A lot of people are angry about this.
Yeah, look, there's blame to go around, but one of the things from an insurance standpoint is if the FDA is approving a drug for use and it's part of a benefit profile, we have to cover it. So that's really where it comes from initially. And so we look to the FDA, we look to the medical community to set standards. And those standards are the ones that we're operating off of. When I made my comment earlier about pharma, I think pharma did a lot of educating of the overall community, the FDA and physicians, of what they thought they found. And you can all draw your own conclusions about what was driving pharma, but that's where I think the drive came from.
The big pharmaceutical companies made a lot of money off of this. And it truly is blood money. I mean, there's no getting around it, doctor. And at the same time, doctors, I'm just saying this anecdotally, but what are your thoughts about the perception that doctors just accept what the pharmaceutical sales rep says? They come by with the line of patter and, oh, this drug is great and your patients are going to love it. And they just kind of, they're busy, they're overworked. They say, okay, yeah, that's good. And this, in a way, that's what has led to this crisis.
You're absolutely right, Melissa. And I don't want to imply that all doctors, you know, knowingly knew that this would be addictive, but prescribed anyway. I think you're absolutely right. There were other factors. They were getting pressure from their medical group, from their hospitals that they were working for, to make sure that they were adequately treating patients' pain. And Big Pharma was very much involved in legislation to, again, make pain as the fifth vital sign, the HEDIS scores. So there's blame to be, you know, had all around systemically. It's has created a real monster in our community. It's very much, like you say, big tobacco. And I think there's going to be severe consequences, particularly for Big Pharma.
Tara tweets the show, treatment needs to be universally available and immediately accessible. Thanks for helping to move this forward. We did a segment on this show just a week or two ago with Lakeview Health, where they pointed out that everyone should have a nasal spray of Narcan in their home or office. In case you see someone who's, or you have a loved one who you think is at risk of overdose, a shot of Narcan will save their life, and it cannot harm anyone. It can only help. So just wanted to make that quick point. Let's take one more call. It's Scott in Orange Park. Hi, Scott. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning.
You mentioned that methadone was an effective treatment. Methadone centers have been around going on 30 years. Methadone is a problem drug. I mean, it's good for long term because it doesn't affect the liver as badly. In 2000, my ex-wife was put on methadone. And at 80 milligrams a day, she had degenerative disc. She had her neck was first plated, then rotted. But I watched her deteriorate. Age 20 years within 10, and become so addicted to this that it shut down her digestive system. She had a foot of stricture removed because once a month, she would run out because she got addicted to them and have to go to, and it was shutting down her digestive system, and she'd go to a hospital, get put on antibiotics and sent back out because your digestive system will sleep. It's the only other organ that sleeps differently than your own sleep habits.
Yeah.
And it would put your digestive system to sleep. Methadone is not one of the problems. What we need to basically do in the country is get back to healthier living. But as long as there's a profit to be made, we're going to have bad chemicals in our food. We're going to have high sugar, high fructose corn syrup. We're going to have Big Pharma basically running the show. We have to get away from the type of society that we have that is money driven.
Yes, Scott. And I thank you so much for those thoughts. And I'm sorry that happened in your family. What about Suboxone, Dr. Buprenorphine? That's another emerging treatment, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Very effective. Buprenorphine, Suboxone, Vivitrol. These are other opportunities for individuals that are addicted to opioids to consider. And I certainly appreciate the caller's very painful story about his wife. I think there has been in the last 20 years much improvement with the methadone treatment facilities and the way they are prescribed. It used to be with some treatment facilities that it was dose and go. Now our methadone clinics that we are funding have wraparound services, group therapy, individual therapy, blood draws, et cetera, to ensure that the individual is being monitored medically so that these kinds of medical complications do not occur. But yes, there are other opportunities for treatment to help individuals titrate off of their opioids.
Well, we thank you both for being with us. Learn more about the system of care at LSF Health Systems at lsfnet.org. And the new data about the opioid crisis is on the GuideWell website. Pat Garrity, CEO of Florida Blue and GuideWell, Dr. Christine Caulfield, who runs LSF Health Systems. Thank you both so much for sharing your insights this morning.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you.
Thank you. And much more still ahead. Later, Generation Wow is lifting up girls across the First Coast. But up next, October is National Cybersecurity Awareness Month. Are you secure online? We'll be right back.
Comcast Business, providing a gig speed network that gets business done. Comcast Business, beyond fast. More at comcastbusiness.com.
Ansbacher Law. Florida law imposes strict time limits on claims for construction defects. Barry Ansbacher is Florida Bar Board certified in construction law and real estate law. More at 737-4600 or ansbacherlaw.com.
Do you have a story to tell? Since 2003, StoryCorps has been collecting and archiving stories from all over the country. From November 18th to December 21st, StoryCorps will be right here in Jacksonville. StoryCorps is the two-time Peabody Award-winning nonprofit whose mission is to preserve and share humanity's stories. If you've ever listened to their NPR program, you know how powerful and touching these stories can be. To find out how StoryCorps can record your story, go to wjct.org/events.
Hi, this is Keith Marks. Join me every Thursday evening at 11 p.m. for Avant Radio, a show of curious music for curious minds. Each show is themed, curated, and contextualized to explore new music. Come get curious on Thursdays at 11 on 89.9 FM.
Welcome back. Well, keeping your personal information secure online. We all want that, but you know what? Most of us aren't doing this quite right. Is your password password, for example? Yeah, you'd be surprised how easy it is for someone to compromise your data on the internet. October is National Cybersecurity Awareness Month, organized by the National Cybersecurity Alliance. Cindy Arco from Comcast is here with more about that. And Cindy, this is something everybody needs to work on, but people just get busy and they don't, right?
Yes, absolutely. And we really all legitimately need to be on the internet every day for all sorts of different things. So there are some really basic things that people probably know about, they've heard before, but it doesn't hurt to remember. Your antivirus software, make sure you have it. Also make sure that you update it. And then also make sure that you're updating your operating systems and your applications, because cyber criminals are always going to be trying new tricks. And so then developers on the other end can come up with things like security patches. But if you're not keeping your apps and your operating systems updated, you're making yourself vulnerable.
Is it that easy, even if you do try to keep things relatively secure, for someone to steal your identity, steal your information?
It depends, I would say. I think that if you are aware of all the information that you're putting out there, it's smart. You know, you said it earlier, is your password password? I think what can be even more important, I mean, obviously strong passwords, uppercase, lowercase, special characters. Yeah. But don't use the same password for everything.
I do that.
I know it's hard.
I'm terrible about that because it's just easy to just enter one thing in.
It is. It is very easy. I know for work alone, I have so many different passwords that I need to remember. And then for each of my children, they have all sorts of different school and doctor's accounts and things like that. And so it is really tough. But on the off chance that someone is able to figure out what that one password is, you've now given them access to everything. Whereas if you only have that for one thing, they're getting a little bit less information.
So since we have to have all of these multiple passwords, what's the easiest way to store them so that we can access them? Because it's impossible to remember them all. How do you do that?
I have an application on my phone called OneSafe. I think it was the free app of the day in the App Store at one point. And so it has a password. And then now also through my phone, it has to, you know, I can do it with my fingerprint. I have to look at it every single day because I, you know, remembering the login and the password for everything. Because if it's not my email, I don't remember what it was that I put on there. And that, you know, goes back to another thing that I think a lot more companies are using, and that's multi-factor authentication.
Mm-hmm. And so tell me about that.
The idea is, for example, when I'm logging into my computer at work, if I am not, if I'm working from home on my laptop, my computer now, it will send, I have to send my work cell phone a text message with a code. And so I have to enter that code in before I'm able to sign in. So now I've had to enter a password, and then I've also had to prove that I have, you know, access to this phone, which I had to, I had to be set up ahead of time. So it's just another level of security, makes it harder for someone to hack in.
Anything else people need to know?
Talk to your children. Your children do need to go on the internet. I mean, starting as early as kindergarten in Duval County Schools, they have to be doing iReady. Make sure your children understand someone on the internet might not be who they say they are. And keep an eye on what they're doing. There's different apps, different programs out there. For example, Comcast, we have our Xfinity XFi app, and you can see who's on what devices. And then you also have the ability to turn it off for your children. So if you don't want your children to be able to be allowed on at a certain time, like, for example, after 8 p.m. when they're supposed to be in bed, you make it so that their tablet can't even connect.
Josh is on the line. Josh, are you there?
Hello.
Hey, Josh.
I had a question for the guest. So you mentioned that we that users should use different passwords for every site, and from my understanding, it's actually your password is not stored as a password on most big companies these days. It's stored as a representation of your password that's a hash, and it's not the same from company to company. So. I thought that it was okay to reuse the same strong password, with reputable sites. Is that accurate?
I would say to err on the side of caution, because the idea of that, you have someone, you know, who is a hacker, or even just someone you know that you don't want having access to your information. Say your password for one account, obviously this wouldn't be it, is, you know, 1234 for your email account. They're able to figure that out. And then they also happen to know who you have your bank account with. So they go in and they try that number and they say, well, let me just try that password. You've just given them the opportunity potentially to get more of your valuable information. And ultimately, you know, as we say, steal your identity. Someone probably might not be able to, just from hacking into your email, be able to know everything about you to misrepresent and pretend that they're you. But if they're able to get into more in one count, they may be able to piece together enough information to do that.
So if you're just tuning in, as we talk about National Cybersecurity Awareness Month with Cindy Arco of Comcast, consider yourself your family's CIO, Chief Information Officer, to protect online health. Use common sense. Use strong passwords, different passwords for different accounts, multi-factor authentication, update your software regularly, and control and limit what you post and what people can learn about you online. That's another one.
Yes, perfect.
Yes. Cindy Arco of Comcast, always good to see you.
Thank you, Melissa. Appreciate it.
And let's all be online safely in a moment. Generation WOW and WOW Jacksonville. We'll be right back.
Comcast Business, providing a gig speed network that gets business done. Comcast Business, beyond fast. More at comcastbusiness.com.
Ansbacher Law. When buying or selling real estate, a board-certified real estate attorney can help transactions go smoothly and protect your interests. Barry Ansbacher, Florida Bar, board-certified in real estate law since 1995. More at 737-4600 or ansbacherlaw.com.
On the next Fresh Air, Paul Dano. He played a teen preacher in There Will Be Blood, a moody teenager who took a vow of silence in Little Miss Sunshine, and portrayed Brian Wilson in Love and Mercy. Dano directed and co-wrote the new film adaptation of Richard Ford's novel Wildlife, which stars Jake Gyllenhaal and Carey Mulligan. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
The far left moving to socialism.
Some say no man can beat Larry Hogan. Well, I'm no man.
If you're gonna date one of my daughters,
a healthy appreciation for the Second Amendment, sir.
The wild world of midterm campaign ads and who's behind them. I'm Tanzina Vega, and that's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
High school is tough.
It's easy to get caught into a trap of blame rather than ownership.
A documentary about a suburban Chicago high school charts the struggle between teachers and students.
Regardless of all those different things, when they come here, they're ours.
What the series America to Me could teach us about education and equity. Next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Well, finally, this hour, it's called Generation Wow, a really dynamic program exposing girls across the First Coast to the positive and the possible. Their big event, Wow Jacksonville, is coming up in a few weeks. Stacy Ellison is with Generation W and Generation Wow, and she's here with more. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to see you. So Generation Wow is focused on building the future women leaders of the world, which is a great goal.
Absolutely. WOW is completely and totally committed to developing the leadership potential in every single girl. And listen, every girl has it, but statistics show our girls don't believe it. Currently, only 1 in 5 young ladies believe they have the qualities to be a good leader. And at WOW, we are committed to really showing girls that, you know what, you can do it, and you have a community of women ready to support you and show you how to start forging your own path.
So at these events, girls are connected with mentors and role models, people that they can look to for a path on what they can go on to achieve. That's so important. You can't be what you can't see, is the saying.
Yeah, it is. And that's a very important part of our program as well. We want to expose the girls, as you said before, to the positive and the possible. And we do that by bringing women to the table from all walks of life, all professions, all different career paths, to show the girls what's possible in their lives. Mm-hmm. We want them to connect with women who they'll be able to call on for years to come for professional advice, for educational advice, for just navigating those tough times of life. We often say we want to provide to the girls all of the things we wish we knew when we were coming along.
Exactly.
So many times, haven't you had a time in your life where you're thinking, man, I wish someone had just told me.
I know.
Yeah, we want to be that avenue for young ladies where we can provide them with that.
You know, when we were girls, the only kind of forum for this was, I don't know, the Girl Scouts maybe? And most girls didn't stick with that beyond elementary school. This is a really structured way to support and empower girls all through the preteen and teen years, when, you know, in the past, we just didn't have that. We didn't have that kind of network.
Yeah. And we
so this is a big deal, I think.
Yes. And, you know, middle school, high school, man, those are tough years.
Yeah.
You are figuring out so many things personally. And then to add on that, you're making really life-changing decisions in terms of, you know, next steps after high school and, you know, what am I wanting to do with my life? And we really, really aim to provide support to young women during those really formative years where they are making those decisions. And guess what? If you don't know exactly what you want to do at 16 or 17, that is okay. It's the time to explore, and we want to just support our young women as they figure it out.
So they need to be aware that this event, Wow Jacksonville, is coming up November 15th on the UNF campus.
14th,
November
yes.
14th.
Uh-huh.
I meant to say that.
Yeah. It's on an early
14th.
Release day.
Yeah. Oh, it's an early release
yes,
day.
Yes, Wednesday.
Wednesday, November 14th on UNF's campus. And right now you are registering girls and mentors. Mm-hmm. It's not too late for women listening out there to sign up to come and be part of this and mentor these girls.
That's one thing we really do want to drive home. While registration is open and filling up quite quickly, there is still an opportunity for the women in our community to raise their hands and say yes, that they want to change the trajectory of a young woman's life by just being available that day, sharing your heart, your triumphs, your challenges, your hangups, all of those things, so that girls can realize, you know what, the path may have some bumps on it, but I can make it. Registration is open for mentors as well as young ladies who would like to come. Often girls come through their schools. We have upwards, usually about 35, 40 schools in the Northeast Florida area represented at the actual event. But if you want to sign up individually, girls can do that as well. So, you know, there are multiple ways in which you can get there. But the first avenue would be to check with your school and see if a group's coming. Mm-hmm. And it's often a nice way to maybe meet some girls you didn't know who you go to school with and come with your school group. But Eventbrite is open now. You can go to genwnow.com. to find out more about the event registration. It's really a wonderful day.
And this is a full day of fun and empowerment.
Yeah, it's from 2 to 6.
Oh, 2 so, afternoon. Yeah. That's right, early
yes,
release.
We really try to plan it on the early release day so that it really doesn't interfere with the educational process for the day. But, you know, the girls, we pack a lot into that 4 hours and want to make sure when they leave, they're thinking, you know what? I got this.
Go to Eventbrite or genwnow.com for Generation Wow. November 14th, it is an early release Wednesday. Bring your girl over there starting at 2 o'clock on the UNF campus. Stacy Ellison is with Generation Wow and just a great person. Always good to see your smiling
face. Always good to see you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for being here. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Michelle Corum is our director. Our theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Piotr Chefchik. And if you missed anything this morning, catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is 89.9. Thanks so much for being with us, and have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.